Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a profile of Paul Ryan, who is being depicted in the press as a moderate who can bridge the divide between the Republican establishment and the Tea Party's Freedom Caucus. The man on the white horse who is riding to the rescue of the Republicans who can't find someone to replace the House Speaker and the Speaker designate. Jonathan Chait, a writer for New York Magazine, who was previously a senior editor at the New Republic, who has extensively profiled Paul Ryan, joins us to discuss his latest article at New York Magazine. Paul Ryan says he will serve as House Speaker, maybe. And how Ryan is being portrayed, quoting Jonathan Chait, as an earnest, fiscally responsible wonk who wants to make government more efficient, as opposed to a devotee of Ayn Rand, determined to stop government from taking rich people's money. Then we'll examine further the enduring influence of Ayn Rand over right-wing politics in America with Gary Weiss, a journalist and the author of two books probing the underside of finances, Wall Street versus America and Born to Steal. He was an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week, and his latest book is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. Then finally, we'll speak with Cora Currier, a reporter at The Intercept who focuses on national security, foreign affairs, and human rights. She is a lead author of The Intercept's just-released investigative report, The Drone Papers, where she wrote the article, The Kill Chain, The Lethal Bureaucracy Behind Obama's Drone War, and we will discuss the findings in the study by the Pentagon's Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Task Force that The Intercept obtained. And joining us now is Jonathan Chait, a writer for New York Magazine. He was previously a senior writer at the New Republic and a former assistant editor of The American Prospect. He has extensively profiled Congressman Paul Ryan for New York Magazine, where he just wrote the piece, Paul Ryan Says He Will Serve as House Speaker, Maybe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Chait.
Thank you.
Glad to be here. And it strikes me as being pretty rich that Paul Ryan is insisting that he wants to spend more time with his family. But this is the same Paul Ryan who voted against paid family leave and in favor of cuts in child care subsidies for poor parents. Is there anything in your profiling of him and having studied him that indicates that maybe he has some inkling that some people see him as a hypocrite?
You know what? First of all, I have to say I think it's admirable that a man wants to spend time with his family and prioritize that and balance that with just his career responsibilities. I think that's something to be commended. I agree with you that there's a lack of awareness here, but of the tension between what he's asking for himself and the rights he's willing to give to other workers who don't have the same leverage that he does to demand these kinds of rights as a concession from people who are desperate to hire him, and not everyone has that kind of market power. But I think if you understand Paul Ryan's worldview, you can see why, from his perspective, this doesn't look like hypocrisy at all. He simply thinks that he has earned this in the market because he is valuable, and the market is what determines who has the right to extract these kind of concessions from their employer, and not everyone is entitled to that, but that because of his abilities and his talents that he has the right to ask to spend more time with his family, and not everyone is entitled to what he has won in the marketplace.
But we know that the marketplace is now a global marketplace. So what's to stop an employer from getting rid of any American worker and hiring somebody in Bangladesh?
Well, nothing. But I think from Paul Ryan's point of view, you know, he trusts the wisdom and the judgment of the marketplace in an almost absolute fashion. So I don't think he's going to concede that the government should be guaranteeing those sorts of rights, or really very many rights at all, to any kinds of workers. He's from the school of thought which says that morality is determined by the marketplace, and that which you are able to produce in the marketplace defines what you're entitled to keep, and it's wrong for government to change that. Now, I don't agree with that philosophy at all, but that is the world as it looks to Paul Ryan.
So he's apparently met late today in Washington with the Freedom Caucus, and essentially he's sort of laid out these conditions, not only that he wants weekends with his families, he wants an endorsement from all major caucuses, he wants the House to change its rules so that disgruntled lawmakers can't remove him as Speaker, as they have done with his John Boehner and scuttling McCarthy. If they don't like the job he's doing. So where do you think he stands in terms of the desperation, apparently, that the more moderate leaders, shall we say, have, that they need to get this thing solved because it doesn't look good, and this obdurate caucus known as the Freedom Caucus?
Well, so first of all, I have to take some issue with your term, and I know you're you're using terms that lots of people are using, and I don't think you fully subscribe to the meaning of it. But nonetheless, when people describe those on Paul Ryan's side as moderates, I think it's important to clarify that this isn't really an ideological difference within the Republican Party. This is a difference over tactics. You have a wing of the party that has about 40 or so votes in the House and the support of a lot of activists across the country that just won't accept the limits of power that comes with controlling Congress but not controlling the presidency. And they've consistently believed that since Republicans control Congress, they should be able to force President Obama to accept their policies, even policies that the president finds unacceptable. And if they simply assert these strongly enough and show enough determination and make their case forcefully enough, they can make the president go along. And they refuse to accept the fact that they're wrong about this. And that's the real split we're dealing with. It's not really a split over what the goal should be. It's just over the limits. So I'm sure you know this, but I tend to object to people who frame this as moderate versus conservative or in terms like that.
Well, but apparently, according to a recent article in the New York Times, the Freedom Caucus consider Paul Ryan is being too liberal. It may well be to do with his position on immigration, which is largely a libertarian position, which is, you know, let any cheap labor come in. You know, that's good for business.
Right. No, you're right about that, that immigration is a substantive disagreement with them. But number one, he's gone to them and promised that he won't bring up a comprehensive immigration bill. So that issue is off the table. And number two, Ryan was a hero of this movement in the Freedom Caucus and a lot of the people who are currently attacking him right now, not long ago, ideologically. It was only when he was in position to become the House Speaker that they decided that he was unacceptable. And that's because anyone who has the chance to exercise real power becomes unacceptable to them because they refuse to accept the limits of that power.
So is there objection then with the Constitution itself, the division of powers? I mean, or is there objection? Is this an objection against reality itself?
I think it's more the latter. They don't have any kind of theoretical program for changing the Constitution so that the party that controls Congress has the ability to impose its agenda without obtaining a veto-proof majority, which is what you need under the Constitution. They don't. Their ideas haven't reached the level of theory. It's just rabid disgruntlement. By the way, the Freedom Caucus had a meeting this evening in Washington with Paul Ryan, and they've come out and they've arrived at a sort of confusing result that I can fill you in on if you want to hear the latest state of play, which is that Ryan was looking for something like unanimous support from the Freedom Caucus in order to assure that they wouldn't be constantly trying to depose him, like with Boehner. And what they reported is that more than two-thirds of the Freedom Caucus supports him, but not 80%. And the Freedom Caucus rules require that 80% of its members must agree to anything in order to make it an official Freedom Caucus position, which is one of the reasons why the group is so unruly, because 80% is a hard target to reach. So more than two-thirds, but fewer than 80% of the Freedom Caucus supports Ryan's bid for Speaker, and now Ryan has to decide if that's enough.
So the tyranny of the minority.
Yep.
But I would think that the deal that, and I'm pretty sure this has been in these meetings in the basement of the House over these last 2 days, where obviously Ryan and Boehner, I imagine, wanted, and the so-called Republican establishment, I won't call them moderates, but the idea being that they've got to get out from under this threat of a debt ceiling crisis, because anybody that knows anything about economics knows this is far more serious than shutting down the government. This will call into question the full faith and credit of the United States and do probably irreparable damage to the U.S. dollar, which is the global reserve currency, which is one of the most amazing advantages that the U.S. economy has. So I'm not sure that the Freedom Caucus understand the economic realities, and I'm not sure that the people that support them, like the Club for Growth and others, I don't quite understand why they don't get it. I'm sure the business community does. So is what's going on in these negotiations an attempt to just get all this stuff passed? In other words, the real conditions for Ryan taking the job is that they get a clean bill through the election year. They're not going to shut down the government. They're not going to play around with the debt ceiling, and they're not going to look really stupid in the election.
Right. So, you know, what the Freedom Caucus wants is to use the threat of a debt ceiling crisis to extract policy concessions from the Obama administration. And the Obama administration gave into this tactic in 2011, but has since learned its lesson and has refused to allow itself to be extorted. Now, the question you ask is, do they realize the consequences of refusing to lift the debt ceiling? And that's an interesting question. Some of them reportedly don't, or at least didn't a few years ago when they started using this tactic. At the very least, they're attempting to use the impression that they don't understand it as leverage. They have no incentive to convey the fact that they realize it, because in a sense, if they don't realize what they're doing, it gives them more power as extortionists. If they can make this threat, you know, and make good on what some of them have said, which is this belief that refusing to lift the debt ceiling will somehow not have any economic consequences, which like you just said, is contrary to the beliefs of everyone who's an expert in this field. So there's some mix of genuine ignorance and feigned ignorance that's behind their attempts to use this as leverage. But we've played this game now a few times since that 2011 episode, and I think it's clear enough that there is a majority of the House, including the Democrats, that knows the debt ceiling has to be lifted, and enough Republican leaders realize this as well, that they won't be able to carry out this threat. So when push comes to shove, the Obama administration is not going to pay a ransom, and the debt ceiling will be lifted. And the only question is, how angry will the Freedom Caucus be at the Republicans who go along with this when it happens?
So you don't think he can make it a precondition of getting the job, just to clear the decks so that they take it off the table?
Oh yeah, it's possible that he can sort of avoid the first round of them screaming their heads off when they lift the debt ceiling. But the next time you have to lift the debt ceiling, they'll be screaming their heads off again.
Sure.
Because that's just what they do.
Right. Well, I think the time is fast upon us. It's early November.
Absolutely.
So in terms of Ayn Rand's influence over Paul Ryan, we've known, for example, that he's spoken about her in glowing, reverent terms, and mm-hmm. had his interns read her books, etc. It's pretty extraordinary that when he accepted the nomination for vice president, he made a speech about his mother, whose story was quite impressive, a widower who got her act together and took the bus every day to University of Wisconsin, got herself a degree, and instead of being a grieving widow, became a small businesswoman. But this is a man who doesn't appear to understand that the mother took the public bus 40 miles every day to Madison on public roads, and the University of Wisconsin is of course a revered public institution that the current governor Scott Walker is trying to eviscerate, and I think their philosophies aren't too divergent. Does he have any sense of? I mean, I know his philosophy is the antithesis to social democracy, but you know, I recall Obama said something in the last election that, you know, that that the government still does stuff, you know, that that the private sector benefits from a lot of stuff that they just don't seem to think. It's almost invisible to them.
Right. Well, it's important to point out that Paul Ryan isn't an anarchist, and even the strictest Randians aren't anarchists. So they recognize the legitimacy of some government functions, and roads are one of the most agreeable functions from that point of view. The functions of government that, that Randians and people like Ryan most disagree with are those that redistribute resources from the rich to the poor. And the reason is that his philosophy, like I said before, tells him that the marketplace is the ultimate arbiter of social value, that people who make more money have created more value and deserve to keep the fruits of their labors, and that interfering with that fairness is the fundamental evil of government. And that's really what he's been spending his career trying to fight. He's fought against progressive taxation consistently, and he's fought against the most progressive spending programs. He's not opposed to military spending. He's not even very strongly opposed to roads and other infrastructure, but he's very critical of welfare programs or anything that that singles out people for aid because they're poor.
Well, of course, he made his money the old-fashioned way by marrying a rich woman. But
marrying a wealthy woman, yeah.
Right. So just in closing, though, I wanted to touch briefly on the vice president finally stopping this tease that he's been going, that's been going on for some time. It seems to be so much of this has been generated by the press. I never saw that there are any solid sources about his a possible presidential run by Joe Biden. And it feels as though President Obama just got sick of it because they were asking him questions yesterday about different opinions over the bin Laden raid. And it's today it felt like Obama just dragged him out there with it and said, here's the microphone, here's the teleprompter, get this nonsense out of the way. What was your take on what happened today?
Well, it's hard to tell what was going on behind the scenes, but there were enough people talking to enough reporters that I think that Vice President Biden was very likely considering this. I think it's almost certain that he was strongly considering running and has wanted to be president for a really long time, and was just torn over whether it was realistic at all and whether he had any path to victory. And he was pretty straightforward about it today. He said no, he just didn't see the path. The window was closed, to switch metaphors. But you know, I think he feels really torn and really badly that he missed his chance.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jonathan Chait.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Chait, who's a writer for New York Magazine. He was previously a senior editor at the New Republic and a former assistant editor of the American Prospect. He's extensively profiled Congressman Paul Ryan for New York Magazine, where he just wrote the piece, Paul Ryan Says He Will Serve as House Speaker. Maybe. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining further the enduring influence of Ayn Rand over right-wing politics in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gary Weiss, who's a journalist and an author of two books probing the underside of finance, Wall Street versus America and Born to Steal. He was an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week, and his latest book is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Weiss.
Hi there, Ian. It's my pleasure.
And it seems that Paul Ryan expecting some kind of coronation here, having met with the Republican caucus for most of the day yesterday. And he set down a bunch of conditions in order for him to accept the job, which he doesn't want, because he clearly has his eye on a presidential run in 4 years' time, having run once as a vice president. So, but the press seems to be framing him as a consensus builder, a bridge builder between the establishment wing and the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. But being a disciple of Ayn Rand and having all of his staff read Ayn Rand, it's just extraordinary to think that this guy's coming off as a moderate in the press.
Yes, it is, really. I mean, if you look back to 2012, if you look back to the presidential campaign, if you look back at his record ideologically, you find that he is indeed a disciple of Ayn Rand. Indeed, as you point out, he did ask his staff to read Ayn Rand. I think that the situation with Ryan is really, to a certain extent, more a question of atmospherics. And also, to a certain extent, it's sort of his chameleon-like character as a politician. As you may recall, even on Ayn Rand, he kind of stepped back and he sort of tried to put the toothpaste back in the tube as far as Rand was concerned, because after all, she is a atheist, and the Christian right is a very important part of the Republican Party's constituency. So, yeah, I think it's really very interesting. It'll be interesting to watch going forward, no question about it.
But the truth of the matter is that he's somebody, he's one of these politicians who spend most of their time going back to the sort of Ronald Reagan adage that government is the problem, not the solution. And he even extends that into the notion of poverty, that that government creates poverty as opposed to tries to help lift people out of poverty. And I know it's a well-worn narrative, but even some have, like the nuns on the bus, have questioned his Catholic faith in regard to his attitude to the poor. I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that this is a guy who's been pretty privileged. And for a guy that beats up on government, his family fortune, for what it is, came from a construction business whose main client was building roads on government contracts. He himself has been a career government employee. He's never had a job in the private sector. And of course, he made money the old-fashioned way by marrying a woman who inherited a fortune. So, I mean, is there any sense that that there'll be any real assessment of who this man is? I know he ran for vice president, so I assume a lot of these issues came up. But I'm just somewhat amazed at the current coverage in the press, which seems he's like the crusader coming to the rescue on a white horse.
Well, the media has not done a particularly good job with Ryan historically. They failed to hold his feet to the fire in terms of his Randian philosophy, and sort of allowed him to get away with, I think, making misrepresentations about his record and about his philosophy. And the media generally has a very poor memory when it comes to politicians. They don't generally do their homework. They don't generally look into the background of the record that politicians have accrued. And in the case of Ryan, they failed to really properly report his strongly held ideology, which is Randian. And Rand philosophy is one step away from anarchy, and is predicated in an extreme point of view that views the government as being, the only legitimate function of government is the police and the courts and the military, and pretty much everything else you're sort of on your own. And that is the Randian ideal, which of course has never been actually executed anywhere in the world. Even if you go back to if you go back to the Wild West, that was never executed. That's sort of the Randian ideal. It's the exact opposite of really American traditions, and it is atheistic, because Rand's bedrock beliefs was atheism. And if you're a real Randian, you're an atheist. and that's how it, you know. And that's kind of the trouble that Ryan got into a few years ago, because, you know, look, you know, he finally dawned on people. Hey, wait a second, are you Randian? Are you? No, you say you are. Well, doesn't that mean that you're an atheist? You can't be an atheist. And then he got him in trouble. So he sort of backed away from that. But I think he's, you know, I don't see any evidence that there's any change in his personal philosophy.
So it's extraordinary then to think that the Tea Party caucus, who essentially Ryan wants to get an agreement from them up front that they're basically, he's not going to go the way of John Boehner and Kevin McCarthy, be undercut and basically, you know, whittled away by their constant uncompromising behavior. But the idea that they consider him as being too liberal, what's happening to our basic definitions then in politics if this very hard-nosed conservative with an extraordinary conservative voting record, Paul Ryan, can be considered by his colleagues to be too liberal?
Well, what you see happening in the Republican Party, you know, particularly that wing of the Republican Party, is that they're appealing to the fringes, and it's sort of the fringes are sort of dictating how the Republican Party operates nowadays. So everybody trying to outflank themselves on the right. So indeed, to some people, they're, you know, somebody like Paul Ryan, because he doesn't always vote in favor of shutting down the government, is viewed as you know, too much of a it's the change in the traditional view of liberal versus conservative in this country. Nowadays, you know, the conservatives, even the John McCain variety, of even the George W. Bush variety, you know, are no longer considered Republicans. They call them rhinos, Republicans in name only, because they're not nihilistic. You know, the Tea Party wing, which, as I point out in my book, is very strongly influenced by Ayn Rand and has been from the beginning, the Tea Party has a certain nihilistic attitude toward it, you know, to tear down the government. It's almost a revolutionary, sort of a revolutionary in a reactionary sense movement. So you're dealing with people from that wing of the Republican Party who, well, first of all, even calling them a wing of the Republican Party might be a bit of an exaggeration. They're really barely in the Republican Party. You have people in that wing who really don't want the government to function. So, you know, you know, as I was pointing out earlier, you know, to the Randians, you really shouldn't have much of a government. So, therefore, when you shut down the government, what is generally not shut down? Well, the military continues to function, the police continue to function, and the courts continue to function. So when you shut down the government, as they've been threatening to do, you kind of wind up with a bit of an Ayn Randian, a Randian paradise. You know, you wind up with a Randian ideal. And since Paul Ryan hasn't always, you know, for reasons of his own, he hasn't always endorsed that, he's been a little bit more willing to compromise, well, he's not good enough. That's a sort of weird situation that you're in now.
Well, but the job that he may take seems to want to take only on his conditions. So obviously he's got some leverage, I guess, because the Republicans are looking so disunited and in disarray at the moment. Is by definition a job that involves a compromise. The Republicans don't run all of the Congress. There is a minority, and it is only one of three branches of government. So those are the inherent limitations here. But the real dangerous issue that's coming up is the debt ceiling, which will come up in early November. And if you're a follower of Ayn Rand, whether or not Ryan is quite as zealous in that regard as the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus people, if the Freedom Caucus people insist on making the debt limit an issue and refuse to increase it, that will have the effect of basically destroying or undermining the full faith and credit of the United States government, and really doing irreparable damage to the US dollar as a global reserve currency, which is a massive financial advantage that the US has always had. So just from the point of view of capitalism, Where are these people? If they're prepared, because of their nihilism, to undermine America's advantage in the global capitalist economy, where does that fit in? Because I always thought that Ayn Rand was a hardcore capitalist. That's the essence of her so-called philosophy.
Well, certainly, and you can obviously use Rand to argue against shutting down the government, that it would cause harm to our capitalist system, that it would be more self-destructive than not. But listen, these are not people who necessarily are, scholars of Ayn Rand or scholars of anything in particular. You know, I'm talking about the Tea Party zealots. We're not talking about people who have necessarily thought through the outcome of shutting down the government. Many of them having read Rand and read, you know, the novels that she's come out with, which sort of show government as being always evil, always malevolent. They kind of like the idea of shutting down the government. As I was pointing out, it's sort of part of their, you know, it's sort of the Randian dream. Okay, so you shut down the government. So what? You're shutting down all these programs they don't like. They haven't really thought through what that means. And the people that they've elected to government have not necessarily thought it through. And also, of course, naturally, these are members generally of the House of Representatives. You're one of 435. You know, you don't really have personal responsibility for the consequences of shutting down the government. You're one of a mob. Kind of, there's a mob mentality taking place here, I think. Certainly the Randians can argue, you know, people who adhere to Randian philosophy, like Alan Greenspan, for instance, can go back and forth on whether it's a good idea to shut down the government and can talk about the impact on the capitalist system. But, you know, fundamentally, you're dealing with people who have this anarchic view of government. And they just don't care. And yeah, it'll harm the full faith and credit of the United States government. They might say, well, so what? You know, they shouldn't be going out. They shouldn't be borrowing money, so we shouldn't have credit. You know, what do you need a credit rating for? We shouldn't be borrowing money or giving this to our grandchildren, that kind of thing. You get that line. So, no, they don't care. That's right. You know, and that's sort of what makes it kind of dangerous, because all the sensible voices in the Republican Party have been sort of drowned out by this fringe element. And I know that makes a lot of people in the Republican Party very apprehensive, very scared.
Well, in his speech at the GOP convention in Tampa in 2012, when Paul Ryan accepted Romney's invitation as the vice presidential candidate on the ticket, Ryan told the story about, after his father's death, how his mother got on a bus every weekday for years and rode 40 miles each morning to Madison. She earned a degree and learned new skills to start a small business, and it wasn't just a new livelihood, it was a new life, and it transformed my mum from a widow in grief to a small businesswoman whose happiness wasn't just in the past. Her work gave her hope. It made our family proud, and to this day, my mum is my role model. Well, what he doesn't point out here in his homily to his mother, which is perfectly fine because she does sound like a wonderful person, Ryan doesn't mention that, first of all, the bus that she took was public transportation. The road that she took every day to Madison, 40 miles on the road, was maintained by the government, and that the University of Wisconsin, where she got her degree, is a public institution, which, by the way, another Ayn Randian right-winger, Governor Walker, is trying to eviscerate and cut their funds. So that kind of disconnect from reality and that hypocrisy reminds me of the fact that Ayn Rand, towards the end of her life, was on Social Security and on Medicaid.
Yeah, she was on Medicare. Medicare, the program for the old. You know, to a certain extent, also what you're describing. You know, the hypocrisy, the failure to understand. It reminds you a little bit of the New Left. You know, ironically, because you'd have protests against the government by students who are in government institutions. You know, government-controlled schools. You know, and people would point out to them, "Hey, wait a minute, kid. You know, you're a product of the system as much as anyone." And I think, you know, the same argument can be made, as you say, directly for the people who are on the far right, who are opposing government, you know, and they themselves and are beneficiaries. I mean, a lot of the supporters of the Tea Party, you know, are in themselves Social Security recipients and are on Medicaid and are not in favor of eliminating those programs. They want everything else eliminated, but not what affects them. And you see that a lot.
Well, of course, there was that famous sign at a Tea Party protest on Capitol Hill, keep government hands off my Social Security.
Mm-hmm. So, that's right.
So there is a certain amount of political illiteracy. But I guess you accept my basic premise here that the press are going pretty softball on Ryan, making him sound like he's the indispensable moderate who can quell the radicals when his voting record is almost identical to the Tea Party's.
Yeah, well, the media has a tendency to do that. When they look at any particular situation, they tend to put things in terms of black and white, in terms of, you know, good guys and bad guys. And in this particular case, you know, Paul Ryan turns out to be a good guy because he's considered to be the moderate compared to all these crazies to the right of him. And in the process, as you point out, they've neglected to point out his own history of radicalism. And that's one of the failings of the media.
So just in closing, Gary Weiss, what's your follow-up now to Ayn Rand Nation?
Well, right now I've been involved in starting up a new nonprofit investigative news organization. It's called the Mideast Reporter. The place you can find it on the Internet is MideastReporter.com. And what my colleague Richard Behar and I are doing is we've begun this nonprofit in order to really just to do, you know, pretty much as you point out with Ayn Rand, how the media has not been not always fair, not always balanced in dealing with Ryan. We're sort of doing the same thing with the Middle East, where, you know, we're seeking to to sort of correct the balance, correct the imbalance, and really just bring hard-nosed, old-fashioned news reporting to the Middle East through our own efforts and through the efforts of people that we'll be bringing on board. So it's very exciting, you know, beginning this new organization. It's really quite a thrill.
Well, Gary Weiss, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's my pleasure.
And then again, I've been speaking with Gary Weiss, who's a journalist and the author of two books, Probing the Underside of Finance, Wall Street versus America, and Born to Steal. He was an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week, and his latest book is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the lead author of The Intercept's just-released investigative report, The Drone Papers. And joining us now is Cora Courier, who is a reporter at The Intercept with a focus on national security, foreign affairs, and human rights. As a reporting fellow at ProPublica, she covered national security and finance, and prior to that was on the editorial staff of The New Yorker and a lead researcher on several books of history and politics. She is the lead author of The Intercept's just-released investigative report, The Drone Papers, where she wrote the article, The Kill Chain: The Lethal Bureaucracy Behind Obama's Drone War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cora Courier.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
And The Intercept obtained a Pentagon study of the Joint Special Operation Command, JSOC's, drone campaign in Yemen and Somalia. And this covered the area of the years 2011 and 2012. And this study was carried out by the Pentagon's Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Task Force. And I understand that The Intercept obtained two versions of the study, a longer presentation dated February of 2013 and an executive summary from May 2013, which includes a slide to show of the chain of command leading to the approval of who gets to be killed in the name of the people of the United States. So I guess at the end of this chain, inexorably, we have President Obama.
Yes, the slide that we have shows how targets are individuals are sort of evaluated, how intelligence is gathered on them and passed up the chain of command through the ranks of the military and eventually to the White House, and ultimately the president signs off on a 60-day authorization for the military to take a strike against that person.
So this is a sort of alternative universe, isn't it, that the Pentagon has created a form of antiseptic warfare, and it does seem obviously to be popular with policymakers because it avoids boots on the ground and body bags. But has anybody done a kind of emperor's clothes study on whether this so-called success is worth the downside, which I presume is the fact that there's a lot of collateral damage, and that these strikes seem to provoke so much rage that they become recruiting tools?
Well, I think what was really interesting about these documents is that this was an internal Pentagon study evaluating the intelligence and both the technology and sort of the quality of the intelligence going into drone strikes. And you hear a lot about drones as a precision weapon, that they are, you know, the most surgical and most targeted way of going after people. But this study was acknowledging that even drones have their limits, that the video technology, the technology that they had for collecting signals intelligence, which is electronic communications intelligence, was not as strong as they would have liked it to be, and that particularly in places like Yemen, the quantity, even the the quality and the quantity of the signals intelligence that they were getting was not what they wanted it to be. So the study is really interesting for showing that even internally there were questions about the quality of intelligence that they were given, and the study actually advocates for a little bit more boots on the ground in terms of wanting more captures, more forward deployed sort of special operations forces working alongside foreign governments, and not just air wars. So that was an interesting aspect of these studies.
Well, apparently the location or the locus of these attacks is Djibouti, right? Camp Lamantine?
Camp Lamantine. Where the counterterrorism task force for the Horn of Africa is based, and that's where the majority of these flights and the drones are based. We also saw in this map, there was a map showing drones based in other parts of the Horn of Africa, also in flying out of Ethiopia at Arba Minch, and also manned airplanes. Also, this is not just about drones. There's also one of the things that I think we tried to emphasize was that there are actually an awful lot of manned surveillance planes flying out of both Djibouti, also out of Kenya, out of Manda Bay, Kenya. And there's also drones flying off of naval platforms in the Arabian Sea and the Gulf of Aden.
Well, what strikes me, though, about this report, Cora Currier, is that the targets are in two of the poorest countries on the planet, Somalia, which is a failed state, desperately poor, and with broken infrastructure and constant war, and Yemen, which is the poorest state in the Arab world, and it's now being pounded by the Saudi Air Force into rubble. So this is also, they talk about drones in terms of asymmetrical warfare. In other words, that we're up against an asymmetrical threat, meaning global terrorism. But by going after the poorest countries in the world, it's asymmetrical in the sense that there's nothing they can do to counter them. Is there any sense in this report that enemies, and now that you've got Russian drones in Syria, presumably flying by American drones, that someday or other the playing field's going to get leveled?
Well, I think that the U.S., for the past 15 years or so, has set the precedent for this form of warfare, for saying that they can do these kinds of operations in areas that are not traditionally defined sort of hot battlefields, places like Yemen and Somalia, where the U.S. is not engaged in anything that looks like a traditional battleground. So, yes, I think now we're going to see other world powers asserting the right to use drone technology and to use, even not drone, even manned planes, in this kind of global counterterrorism framework that the U.S. has promulgated.
Well, it seems to me that since the Iranians captured an American drone, and a very advanced one at that, They literally took it over and flew it back into Iran and put it on display, that surely at some point or other, somebody's going to capture one of these drones and redirect it, and it's going to do some terrible collateral damage that could end up, you know, injuring the U.S. much more than the use of any drone could possibly benefit us.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know of any specific concerns about that, but definitely there's, you know, just a question of how these things are going to be used by other countries, how, you know, the UN has sort of despaired, I think, at this point of setting a sort of global framework for the rules of how these are going to be operated.
And again, I'm speaking with Cora Currier, who's a reporter at The Intercept with a focus on national security, foreign affairs and human rights. As a reporting fellow at ProPublica, she covered national security and finance, and prior to that was on the editorial staff of The New Yorker and a lead researcher on several books of history and politics. She is a lead author of The Intercept's just-released investigative report, The Drone Papers, where she wrote the article, The Kill Chain, The Lethal Bureaucracy Behind Obama's Drone War. But in terms of the collateral damage, in 2011 and 2012, there were at least 54 U.S. drone strikes and other attacks reported in Yemen, killing a minimum of 293 people, including 55 civilians. So according to the figures that of the breakdown of collateral damage were done by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, so what is the ratio? I guess it varies, but in terms of this, the statistics on Yemen, of the 293 people, 55 civilians died, but is that the ratio?
Well, the thing is, we don't know the specific ratios, in particularly in a place like Yemen, and there's a number of reasons for that. Some of that is just the inherent difficulties of following up on these strikes, and as you said, this is a very poor country. These are there are not a lot of media on the ground. There's not a lot of access by international groups who can, you know, sort of evaluate the aftermath of any given U.S. strike. And one of the concerns that's raised by our reporting is that, you know, the military has a, we've been told that the military often labels people as so-called EKIA, or enemy killed in action, after a strike, unless evidence emerges to prove otherwise. So unless there are, you know, is very obvious evidence of it, that a child was killed or that a family was present or some, you know, some sort of outside evidence emerges that there was a mistake made, that the general assumption is that if they're young military age men in the vicinity of a target, that, you know, that they're going to be labeled as enemies after the fact. And that's a very controversial position. That's also, there's also the, that's a sort of post facto evaluation of what happened in a strike. There's also a policy of carrying out what are known as signature strikes, or terror attack disruption strikes, which is strikes on groups of people who are exhibiting a pattern, a suspect pattern, based on surveillance that the military might not actually know the identities of each person. They might not be high-value targets in the way that a specific leader that they know the name of, but they look enough like they're a threat that the military takes them out. And we don't, you know, we don't really know who these people are and what role they play in a group like Al-Qaeda.
Well, we know at least of one instance where a mistake in targeting was made. The White House announced that two hostages held by Al-Qaeda, an American and Italian, had been killed in a CIA drone strike in Pakistan in January. And apparently they had gone to great lengths to decide that the prisoners were not in the building that they were striking. And presumably they thought they were just striking those who were holding them. And it turned out that they were there and that they died. So to that extent, at least the imperfections of the system have been acknowledged.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I think that that's something, that strike was a very rare occasion where the administration came out and said that this was, you know, unintentional, that this was a mistake and that there were innocents killed, and they offered something of an explanation for it. Generally, for example, in the case of Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, the son of the preacher, the Al-Qaeda-linked preacher, Anwar al-Awlaki, he was killed in a drone strike in Yemen in 2011, and the U.S. has offered no public explanation for why that happened. They've said officially that he was not specifically targeted, but that doesn't explain, you know, was it a mistake? Was it a, you know, was he next to someone who was specifically targeted? Did they know he was there? And, you know, there's just many, many, many cases of civilian casualties that aren't explained in the way that that CIA one was.
But it seems that in this report, there is at least an admission that there's an over-reliance on signals intelligence. And in that, to that extent, I assume that it means tracing the cell phones, which seems to be the way at which these targets are triangulated and then taken out. But there is, I think in the case of the father of Al-Awlaki, the preacher, there was a Danish human intelligence aspect to it. A guy from Denmark, a jihadi, had procured women for a bride for him, and they were able to track him to that extent. But by and large, it seems that there's a tremendous reliance on which I assume is cell phones.
Yeah, our documents show that, you know, at least for this period in Yemen, they said that over half of the intelligence that went into locating new targets was coming from signals. And, you know, we had people on sort of on all sides of the spectrum of this, of in terms of pro and counter these kinds of operations, acknowledge that this was a problem, that when you're tracking somebody's phone, you are tracking somebody's phone, and that the groups that you're tracking, the Al-Qaeda operatives, are actually very savvy to this, and they know, you know, there are various ways to either plant misleading information via, because they know their phones are being tracked, or, you know, by switching out SIM cards, by, you know, moving around. But yet the signals intelligence was still critical, these documents show, for in terms of them determining that they had the right person. They also point out that the video that they are looking at from drones, that the quality of the video was not always as high as they wanted, that they were, you know, not always able to get to use it to ascertain with absolute certainty that the person they're looking at is was the one they wanted. And I think, you know, again, there's this sort of mythology around new drone technology that it's just perfect, and that the, you know, you're looking at crystal clear imagery, and you're not. And these documents have a very frank admission of some of the limits of the intelligence that can be gathered from them.
So, you know, I mean, all you have to do is take the battery out of a cell phone to at least stop the fact that it keeps pinging looking for towers. So I'm sure that it's probably not difficult to imagine that some of these people have, you know, either been set up or somebody's just left a cell phone somewhere as a diversion or whatever. I mean, in other words, going back to that earlier question about how the Iranians captured a drone and the drone could be used against us, I mean, the extent to which a terrorist could just leave a cell phone at a wedding party is not hard to imagine, right?
Well, and, you know, the military say that they, you know, use different forms, that, you know, that they have to confirm with, you know, near certainty, as they say, and our documents say that they need two forms of intelligence, proving that the person is the intended target, to positively identify the person. But sources that we spoke to said that was, you know, not quite as rigorous as it might sound to have two different forms of intelligence, and that it was still, signals intelligence was still vulnerable to that kind of, you know, counterintelligence and exploitation.
So how much does the CIA director, John Brennan, feature in this? I know he's up near the top of the chain of command, along with General Clapper, the DNI, and I understand that there's a very strange individual at the Director of National Intelligence's office out there in Tyson's Corner, who is supposed to be the drone master, a rather eccentric man who rarely sees the daylight, sleeps in his office, and is a devout Muslim. But does he come up on the radar?
Well, the documents that we're looking at are about the military's program. So the CIA has their own, I think, more sort of cloistered process for approving drone strikes and approving targets for strikes. You know, there's definitely overlap between the two agency lists and the people that they're looking at, and certainly some coordination out of the White House. But it is two separate processes, and the process that we were looking at was for the military. So that shows again how they, you know, at the White House, you have someone like John Brennan, who's now the CIA director, but at the time covered by this study, he was the counterterrorism advisor to President Obama, and by all reporting was extremely influential in making recommendations to the president about who was a valid target. And the idea is that he would take this sort of interagency group. The idea behind concentrating it in the White House was to give sort of an extra level of scrutiny from other agencies so that it wasn't just the military kind of operating on a sort of war footing tempo, saying, yes, let's go after this person, this person, this person, that it would have a more the idea was that that was actually a more accountable process. But the CIA's process is much more, we know less about it. We don't know exactly how their chain of command works.
So it's reasonable to assume that both JSOC's chain of command and the CIA's chain of command all end up at the same place at the pinnacle, right? Or how independent would the CIA be? Surely they still, at some point, have to get the approval from the top.
And there's been sort of varied reporting on the CIA and which exact kind of strikes have to be signed off on by the president. If there's going to be, and I think it's varied over the years. There's been reporting after a particularly egregious instances of civilian casualties that the White House will sort of will call them back in and sort of rein them back in and demand more that they have more say so before individual strikes. So I think it's varied over the years.
So just in closing then, Cora Currier, since you worked on this study, of course, that this does elicit a lot of passion amongst people who, I don't know that there's too many passionate supporters of drones, and there have been reports even of PTSD amongst drone operators sitting in caravans thousands of miles away from the where the deaths occur, but presumably the PTSD comes from what the drone shows them after the strike, the collateral damage. But those that oppose it are quite passionate, and, it's often struck me as a sort of difficult to understand the difference, if you will, between sticking a bayonet in somebody's belly as opposed to zapping them with a drone. But there's a sense that this is a cowardly form of warfare as opposed to the manly form of warfare where you look in the guy's eye as you stab him with a bayonet. So I'm not sure as a species where we stand on that one.
Well, I certainly think that the debate over drones gets kind of hung up on the technological aspect, the idea that this is a completely novel form of war. But in fact, as I was pointing out, there's still an awful lot of these surveillance and of actual strikes are still being carried out by traditional manned piloted planes. And, you could make arguments about what kinds of airstrikes actually put the pilots at risk and stuff. And so whether, the sort of, certainly there's definitely drones have introduced a new kind of lowered the threshold for taking certain kinds of strikes and going to places where the U.S. certainly would not put any kind of sizable troop presence. So in that sense, yes, they've increased the distance and lowered the threshold for conflict. But I do think that in many cases, the sort of word drone, and we did call this series the Drone Papers because it's mostly about drones, but the word can obscure the policy and, looking at the sort of strategic questions about it's whatever tools we're doing it. The fact is that we're, killing people in these countries and, the public can, ought to know that and ought to debate it.
Well, Cora Currier, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Cora Currier, who's a reporter at The Intercept with a focus on national security, foreign affairs, and human rights. As a reporting fellow at ProPublica, she covered national security and finance, and prior to that was on the editorial staff of The New Yorker and a lead researcher on several books of history and politics. She's the lead author of The Intercept's just-released investigative report, The Drone Papers, where she wrote the article, The Kill Chain, The Lethal Bureaucracy Behind Obama's Drone War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.